Good morning. I'm Craig Cohen. This is Focus 580 on the Information Advantage. I'm sitting in for David Inge, and this is our daily telephone talk program. In this hour of Focus, the topic is women's health. Our guest, Dr. Suzanne Troopen, who is, let me make sure I get this right, clinical professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois College of Medicine. She joins us once a month to answer your questions on women's health. And our phone numbers are 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. Good morning, Suzanne.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
I'm glad to have you back, as we do every month. And I didn't know if you came prepared to talk about anything in particular.
I had been following some of these same stories in the news as you did, and I brought some new pictures for you. I think someday we'll be able to just flash those up on your website.
That's
and everybody
right.
can see the pictures even while listening to radio. But I think that you and I can do a good pictorial essay for our listeners on some new ultrasound advancements. And there's actually been quite a few things in the news, so we'll have plenty to talk about this morning.
All right, well, why don't we jump right in and talk about these pictures. These are three-dimensional ultrasound photos?
Right. Most people know that ultrasound is using sound waves to bounce off the fetus and acquire an image through computer interpretation of the bouncing sound waves. And actually, when we get an ultrasound picture, a traditional ultrasound picture that most women are familiar with, we're sending pulses of about 1,000th of a second back to the machine. And so most of the time, there's no sound actually even going towards the baby. So it's very, very safe. And we're using a computer to generally generate what we call a two-dimensional image. And we've been able, through the use of what we call grayscale enhancements, in other words, making certain part of the structures look darker or less dark, we've been able to generate the illusion of three dimensions because our eye sort of can imagine a little bit about the dimensions. But basically, doing two-dimensional ultrasound was sort of an acquired phenomenon so that a trained physician or an ultrasonographer could really understand the image they're looking at, whether it be a baby face or the inside of the baby's brain. But it took a little bit more understanding on the part of the family to be able to really see the features that we are looking at to try to understand anatomy. Well, they've been able to, with an additional way of aiming the beam and using the computer and training sonographers to generate a 3D image with all the information coming in from the three dimensions. So you get two dimensions in one direction and two more in the other direction, but the one of the other two is the same as the first two.
Right.
If you can,
thus three dimensions.
Thus you get three dimensions. And then you can use the computer to put this together and generate an actual three-dimensional picture. And I brought some for you to see. And I think you'll agree this one shows here's the baby's brow, there's an eye, here's the nose, here's the mouth. And you can really see very clearly three-dimensional features. Now, when we want to see more, like focused on the fingers, something like that, we would have to aim our beam in a slightly different direction. And I pulled some of these pictures quickly together, and I'm not sure, but I think this one, for instance, shows the hand in a little bit different image. So you have to play with the image a little bit. It's not always something somebody can see when they walk in the front door and get their ultrasound. They can see the two-dimensional pictures, but usually the three-dimensional image we have to work with computer-wise to really generate the good picture. But I think you can see on some of these pictures, you can really see the baby's features, and you could be able to really detect certain kinds of things that the doctors would be looking for. The patient's saying, oh, this is Uncle Harry's chin. But the doctor's looking to see that there is a chin. There are certain anomalies that where you don't even have that in, or the width that the eyes are apart, or actually whether they're cleft lips, cleft palates. And then we can begin to translate this technology. I was reading in one of the lay press journals that, and you know, there's so much medical information out there, that this technology probably will become standard of care in the next 5 to 10 years. But actually, it already is here now. And we'll be able to take this technology and apply that to the heart or the liver or other parts of the baby's anatomy to really try to help even increase more our understanding of certain kinds of birth defects. I did bring this one picture. I thought it was pretty dramatic. That's a color flow picture for you to see down there in the corner. And that baby is 14 weeks from conception. That is a very young pregnancy, just moving from the end of the first trimester into the second trimester. And I think you can see pretty clearly these hatch marks, that represents the spine. And these, and the color flow represents the flow of blood through the baby's blood system. So the little bulb area is actually the heart. And then the little stripe down the back is the aorta. And when we do color flow, the blue and the red represents the flow to and from the direction of the machine. Doesn't always represent venous and arterial the way you might think it would. You can set it up that way if you want to, but that's not what's so important. But using the color to really set off the vascular features away from the rest. This is the head. That's where the neck is. Hopefully you're getting pretty oriented. You can see at a very, very early age, even the chambers beginning to form within the heart and really increase your accuracy in terms of figuring out, for instance, heart anomalies, which about, let's see, I think we would expect 3 to 4 per 1,000 babies, something like that, on the order of that. That's considered a common anomaly, but it's not that common if you think about it. Most of the babies we scan will have normal hearts. So we're using these technologies to be able to take even sonographers who mostly scan healthy babies and allow them the ability to find abnormalities that they just couldn't see before because of the technology.
I've got to be honest with you, this one picture where you talk about the color scheme looks a little like weather radar.
I used to have a professor that said that about ultrasound in the early days, but and that's what I mean. Some of these older techniques, you really do, you have to be trained to know what you're looking
at.
Well,
it's interesting you bring that up because, whenever I have seen an ultrasound in the past, it's always, the doctor will say, well, here's the baby's head, and I'll go, uh-huh, sure. Yeah, it kind of looks like it could be round. I don't know.
It's true.
But these are much more detailed, and this is really very impressive.
It is impressive. It's exciting. It's always exciting in medicine when we get new technologies, or those of us that work with the technologies get pretty excited, so.
That's Suzanne Truppen. She's clinical professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois College of Medicine. And she's here for our monthly chat on women's health. If you have any questions or comments on that subject, by all means, give us a call at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. I wanted to ask you about a conference that you attended in Chicago where you gave a lecture on a certain combination of drugs that can help women who are dealing with the side effects of menopause?
Well, as many of us have come to realize that estrogen is fairly ubiquitous, meaning that it affects so many parts of our body. It affects the brain, it affects our eyes, it affects our teeth, it affects our colon, lots of organ systems that we haven't come to think about as traditionally organs that are female hormones effect. Also, we've known for a long time that estrogen, of course, affects the bone system and the heart system as well. So that as we have begun to treat women in menopause, we've started to discover that there are many women who do get adequate response in many of these body areas, so that if you go on hormone therapy, you have half your risk of heart attacks, half your risk of strokes. If you have a heart attack or a stroke, it's less likely to be fatal. Your bone density tends to be preserved to some extent. Women have less macular degeneration of the eye, less colon cancer, lots of these things which we have talked about. Yet, excuse me, there are many women who do not have full therapeutic effect. In other words, about 10 to 15% of women on good levels of estrogen will still continue to lose bone in menopause. About 3 to 5% of women will still have severe hot flashes, and another 5 to 15% of women will occasionally have hot flashes. Some women still do get heart attacks and strokes, so we're starting to look at the patients in the big picture of the way and talk about what other things that we can do for our patients to get full benefit of medical therapy in menopause. And what that is going to mean for some women is to take more than just their typical hormone replacement therapy, so that they need to, for instance, be taking estrogens, but if they have very high lipid or cholesterol levels, they may also need a statin drug. They may need to be taking their estrogens if they've got osteopenia, which is low bone mass, or osteoporosis, which is actual bone thinning. But these patients may also need to take something like a bisphosphonate. And with the bisphosphonates, there are two. There's Fosamax, and then there's the new medication that was just released, Actonel, has a slightly better side effect profile. So they may need to add that in with their estrogens. For women who have reduced sex drive, reduced muscular energy, they may need to add testosterone in with their estrogen, so that we're starting to talk about not just adding progesterone in to hormone replacement therapy, which helps prevent breast cancer, but looking at our patient as a whole patient and realizing that they're going to need more than just estrogen for the next 40 to 50 years to preserve their menopausal health.
It's interesting that we can now use patches to deliver hormones to the
patches
body.
Are a great system. They, with hormones, they avoid what we call the first pass effect. So what that means is that if you swallow a pill, it first goes to your liver. So you will get full liver effects. Now, that's good if you want to lower your cholesterol maximally, but that's bad if you want to avoid some of the clotting factor abnormalities and some of the potential blood sugar abnormalities as you get up into higher levels of estrogen therapy. So you avoid the first pass effect, and you also can deliver a very, very even stream of hormone so that the hormone leaks from these patches across into your system. And we currently have patches that just have estrogen. We have patches that have estrogen and progesterone, and they're about to release patches with testosterone. Now, they've got to adjust those. There's some patches that are coming out with male levels of testosterone, and we're looking at different patches that have female levels. And then I guess what, now that we're all watching the Olympics together, we're going to have to wonder, well, now if you take a male patch, what's going to happen to your testosterone? And it will go up, definitely. So.
No, really, that's a shoulder pad. I need that for the race.
Well, and that's exactly right, that some medications do require such a big patch that that is a problem in terms of effective delivery. But part of modern medicine is to make the individual particles of hormones so tiny that they leak effectively from very, very tiny patches. So, for instance, one of the estrogen patch companies, Vivel, just came out with this thing they call the Vivel Dot. And the Vivel Dot literally is the size of a dime. And it's quite comfortable to wear. I was noticing in the Olympics some of the runners stuck their name tags on their legs, mm-hmm. Or their numbers, you know, their running numbers. They actually stuck them on their legs, and those things look pretty good size. So I was thinking, and my patients complain about a little patch now and then.
Well, and your patients aren't running in any races necessarily.
Exactly. But it seemed uncomfortable there. But yes, those patches are much, much bigger than anything we give our patients.
There's a survey out by the World Congress on Fertility and Sterility, which suggests that women sometimes resort prematurely to technologies like in vitro fertilization to become pregnant. Maybe they don't fully understand some of the things that they could do to become pregnant before going to that route.
I saw that report, and we have to understand it's one thing to walk into a grocery store and buy a bottle of aspirin and say we take an aspirin too soon for a headache. It's another thing to say that a patient does in vitro fertilization too soon. This requires a tremendous team of technologists to give her those treatments. So I would say that maybe the doctors are advocating in vitro fertilization a little bit too soon. And I think part of that, I think it's a whole mess when it comes to infertility treatments. There become a whole lot of other issues around getting pregnant, the timing of your pregnancy relative to your work, the timing of your pregnancies relative to your other children, The fear of getting too old. Everyone knows that as we age, our fertility goes down. And so suddenly some women who first start trying to get pregnant in their mid to late 30s may feel like just because of their age alone, they need to get fertility treatments. And I think these are the kinds of issues that push women to premature fertility treatments. And I think that women need to sit down with a more primary care type provider first when they're planning their pregnancy and go over what their risk factors really are, go over the kinds of reasonable things they can do on their own to enhance fertility. Their partners can wear boxers instead of jockeys because that keeps the sperm temperature more normal and actually increases your sperm count. You can both abstain from alcohol. You can get plenty of rest, be as low in stress as you can possibly be. You can use basal body temperature charting to help detect ovulation. There are over-the-counter test kits that you can get in any grocery store or pharmacy that can help you pinpoint ovulation to enhance your chance of conception. Just some of these basic strategies that women can do first before they ever get into the hands of somebody that delivers tertiary care infertility. Then it also is probably important to stand back and get somebody to interpret some of the studies for you. Just because, say, in vitro fertilization may have had a, say, 20 to 30% chance of conception per cycle, whereas, for instance, maybe accurate timing ovulation induction would have a 15 to 20% chance per cycle, the number of months it's going to take you to become pregnant may not be that different in your particular case. And so you have to interpret the data a little bit rationally before you make a decision on which technologies to use.
We were talking a few minutes ago about some of the hormones that can be used to deal with the side effects of menopause, and it suddenly occurred to me that there is also a study out, from the Netherlands, which suggests that there's another benefit to some of the hormone replacement therapy, that if you take female hormones for at least a year, it could reduce a woman's risk of the hardening of the arteries, right?
Well, estrogen has very, very potent vascular effects. We know that the disease atherosclerosis is something that's rampant in most industrialized countries, but particularly in the United States. Unfortunately, autopsy studies done even on children show that children as young as 8, 10, 12 years of age will already have the process begun of plaque formation, which it leads to eventual clogging of the arteries. And eventually, if there's enough damage to the artery wall, it becomes less resilient and becomes what's called harder, quote unquote. And there are many factors that affect this process. Your level of cholesterol, if there's just tons more cholesterol circulating, some of it may stick in parts of your arteries, particularly very tiny arteries, like the arteries that feed the heart muscle. Also, the plaque formation has to do with our blood clotting factors, and anything that increases the overall levels of inflammatory compounds in our arteries will affect that. And we actually know that certain types of diet that are deficient in B vitamins can affect that as well. And it turns out that estrogen is one of the very potent factors that has to do with not only what the overall level of cholesterol is, but the types of cholesterol that are circulating in the body, the amount of clotting factors. Estrogen seems to have a direct effect on the vascular lining or the endothelium of the vessels so that the plaques may not stick. And also estrogen may as well stabilize the plaque. We don't think that the plaque being there is as big of a problem as, in fact, when the plaque breaks off and causes a clot, and that clot then blocks off an artery seems to be the precipitating event for many disasters of the cardiovascular system, such as a heart attack or a stroke. And so that estrogen can affect all those things, so that we really think that estrogen is very, very important for cardiovascular health for the average woman. Now, you have to take that into context. They did a study last year called the HERS study that was published in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association. And the HERS study took women that already had heart disease. They were over the age of 65. I think the average participant was about 67 in that study. They had had a heart attack, or they had some other consequence of cardiovascular disease, and they started all these women on estrogen, and they had a control group that didn't take estrogen, and they had increased numbers of heart attacks that first year of the study in the estrogen users. And that scared a lot of us. We didn't know how to explain that study. It was only one study, but there's a large other couple of trials, the Nurses' Health Study, another couple of studies coming out of Europe, like you were referring to. And those studies seem to indicate the same kind of information, that there's a couple of different things going on. There's somebody that takes good care of herself, has pretty good heart status as she's going into menopause and gets started on estrogen therapy, versus someone with established heart disease, maybe think twice if she never took estrogen therapy on getting her on. But once those patients in the HERS study got past that first year of the study, by the third to fourth year, the estrogen users were outliving the placebo users. So that we think that there's an acute effect and a chronic effect. We're going for that chronic long-term effect, but we have to account for the new start problem. And exactly how we're going to account for that: do you put them on statins? Do you start them on baby aspirin a day? Do you give them folic acid supplementation to reduce their homocysteine level? Those are the kinds of things that can probably be done. And what I'm advocating for my patients is to carefully step back, be evaluated for where are your risk factors really? Does everybody in your family live to 100 and not have heart attacks up until that time, never have strokes? Does nobody go into heart failure? If that's your family history, then we don't need estrogens to prolong your life. Estrogens are maybe going to do less for your cardiovascular system, not more. But if you are too inactive, maybe a little overweight, maybe your cholesterol's up a little bit, perhaps you've been a smoker at some point in time, perhaps your blood pressure's creeping up a little bit, those individuals are going to very much benefit in terms of their heart from hormone replacement therapy. And it's because of all the powerful effects of estrogen on the vessel wall. Estrogen can help relax the vessel wall. Estrogen can bring the vasodilating substances that actually locally increase the blood flow through a certain passage and really help your heart.
Should stress that, of course, some of these studies are simply suggesting that there is a possible benefit here. And so this is no excuse to go out to fast food restaurants every meal and chow down on fried food, right?
Well, you know, it's interesting. They did a monkey study like that.
Yeah.
They, Miles Stanfler, in a very famous monkey study where they took some macaques, and they have a very similar cardiovascular system to humans, and they fed one group what you would call fast food,
right?
Very high cholesterol diet, and they fed another group the same high cholesterol diet. But the first group, they also gave them, and in this study, they were using birth control pills, which are very similar to hormone replacement therapy medicines, but stronger, much stronger, higher estrogen level, and the progesterones are a little bit stronger. Although we've released some products that have some similar compounds. But anyway, the group on estrogens, which were in the form of birth control pills, didn't have so much of a lower cholesterol level. Both groups ended up with fairly high cholesterols with this diet that they fed them. But when they did studies on the monkeys' vessels, they found that the groups taking the birth control pill had much less hardening of the arteries and plaque formation. And so you're right for many reasons. We need to be moderate in terms of our diet. But actually, the research is there that even poor living can be overcome by to some extent, in some people, by the right combination of medical therapies.
Well, I'm certainly not one to suggest, you know, how well somebody should eat. I have my issues with that. Let me take a moment to reintroduce our guest. This is Dr. Suzanne Truppen, clinical professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois College of Medicine. This is our monthly chat on women's health. If you have any questions or comments for Dr. Truppen, give us a call at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. We have, another 20 minutes or so plenty of time for calls if you'd like to call us. Another, I know we seem to keep jumping back and forth between menopause and pregnancy.
But, actually, we might be getting a call, so I didn't know.
All right. Well, I just want to mention this one other study, which suggests that a woman's diet in early pregnancy might affect the baby's health. What are some of the things that women, when they first become pregnant, what are some of the, maybe, are there specific foods that they should be looking for or types of foods?
Well, most of the research on what you should eat as you are early pregnant has to do with, I mean, most of the studies on what you should eat in pregnancy look specifically at the big picture of pregnancy. How much iron a baby will need to fully form its blood system, how much calcium the baby will need to fully form its bones, so forth and so on. And for sheer growth of the baby, it's primarily sugar. We actively pump sugar across the placenta into the baby. So that it's generally been felt that women don't need so many extra calories. And in the old days, we used to say that over the course of pregnancy, you need about 300 extra calories per day, which, you know, a piece of bread is 150. So,
right.
And in the early pregnant stage, we've never told women to get extra calories in. And in late pregnancy, they need more of these calories. But now most of the research shows that so many of us take in so much extra caloric content just from portion control problems that we have in the United States because of potatoes.
That would be me.
Well, our potatoes have gone from being one potato to being three. And, you know, you still grab one object and stick it on your plate, but it's grown for you. And so that is some of the problem with our nutrients. And then some of the research studies and their large institutes like the Institute of Medicine and American College OBGYN and various national nutrition groups that have come out with their recommendations have pretty much specifically looked at things like what do you need in terms of all the vitamins and so forth, and mostly have concluded that prenatal vitamin supplementation is probably only necessary if you have to restrict your calories for any reason or to get at least the specific level of folic acid in, because we know that folic acid specifically in the right quantities can help prevent things like the neural tube defects affecting the brain and affecting the spinal column. So that's where most of the research has gone. And now there are some of these new studies creeping into the media that are talking about other kinds of nutrients that may very specifically affect the baby's health. And I'm not sure enough work's been done in large enough patient populations to change from eating a balanced diet with a little extra protein and taking a prenatal vitamin onto something else that they're mentioning. I'm not sure which study you're specifically quoting, but I know there were a couple in the media.
This was out of England. Tom Fleming of the University of Southampton, conducted this study.
And was he making any other specific recommendations past what we usually tell women to do?
Well, apparently this is they based it on rats. They did a study with rats, which indicated that a low protein diet for 4 1/4 days after they mated, then a normal diet for the remainder of the pregnancy. Would cause, and let's see, it looks like low birth weights.
Growth retardation. Yeah. Well, unfortunately, the only studies that have been done in humans were pretty much done during wartime, where they specifically looked, there was a famous Dutch study where they specifically looked at women who were deprived of food when they were either in their first trimester, second trimester, or third trimester, depending on when the wartime famine hit and where exactly they were in their pregnancy. And in terms of the first trimester, that's when all the fetal parts are being formed. So you have slightly higher rates of miscarriage and more serious kinds of long-term anomalies. By the third trimester, babies are kind of like us. They've put on a little bit of extra reserve, and it's not as serious in terms of their weight. Other than that, you pretty much have to switch to animal research, and rats are an attractive model because we can get them to mate fairly frequently, and they have very short gestational cycles, so you can carry out an entire study in fairly short time.
Well, why don't we take some phone calls? We have someone on line number 4 on a cell phone. Hi, welcome to Focus 580.
Thank you. I would like to know, I've heard that the estrogen patch that is used by many women is not as effective in heart disease as the one that you take orally as far as pill form. Is that correct?
To some extent, yes, that is correct, because the estrogen patch won't have as potent effects on the lipid levels, so that the patch will slightly increase total cholesterol, will very slightly raise HDL cholesterol and slightly lower LDL cholesterol, whereas pills, now all this is dose dependent, so a lot depends on the dose of the patch and the dose of the pills, but the pills will raise total cholesterol, but dramatically raise HDL cholesterol. That's the good kind of cholesterol, and more dramatically lower the LDL cholesterol, so that your ratio to good and bad cholesterol is very much more favorable. But some of these other kinds of vessel wall effects on the cardiovascular system should be the same with the patch and pills.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. And let's go on now to line number 1, caller from Charleston. Good morning.
Hi, I'd like some information about the procedure that's used for DEXA scans when they check bone density.
Okay. DEXA scans, it's very simple. It stands for dual energy X-ray absorptiometry. Don't ask me to spell it.
That was simple?
Yeah. They shoot a plain X-ray beam in one direction and another X-ray beam in another direction, and those beams are 90 degrees perpendicular to each other, and they get a two-dimensional area calculation of your bone thickness. Now, most of us think of our bones as three-dimensional, and in fact, they are. And the true, when they talk about the thickness or the quote-unquote density measurement of bone, most of us who had to suffer through, and actually, I loved physics, so I shouldn't say it that way, but most of us who took physics in high school and college remember that the density is a thickness. It should be an area. But what the computer does is it calculates the third dimension, because most of us stop growing. That's why some of these measurements are not so accurate in very young individuals, because they're still growing. The computer can't take into account as to where they should be in terms of their growth. So it's actually a two-dimensional reading, and the computer compares you to a standard, and what you get is a T-score and a Z-score. And your Z-score compares you to everybody else your age. And that's not so important, because if you get to be 85, all of us are going to have very thin osteoporotic bones, so that the score that we kind of look at and interpret is called the T-score, and that compares you to a young adult. Now, that tells you whether or not your bone thickness is at normal fracture risk, meaning that if we get hit hard enough, all of us are going to break our bones. We know that. But as we get thinner and thinner, thinner bones, we move from a normal T-score down to what is called an osteopenic T-score. down to a even lower T score that is called an osteoporotic T score. And the World Health Organization has the main classification that most of us go by. Now, there are other organizations that have their own classification system. So if two ladies went to a different spot to get their bone density and they both sat there with their reports trying to make heads or tails, may not be identically interpreted. But I use the World Health Organization greater than 2.5 standard deviation T score. Below normal T score is considered osteoporosis.
Is there an alternative to using x-rays such as ultrasound available?
There is an ultrasound of the heel, it's a little bit less accurate, but it's pretty good. You can use peripheral bone density measurements on the finger and the wrist or the heel, and the heel also has an ultrasound test. When I do the peripheral measurements, I've compared them side by side at fairs and things like that. The peripheral measurements all measure about the same, but because you walk on your heel and you can get actually a little bit of compression of the heel could measure denser without really meaning that all your bones are quite that dense. Usually peripheral scans, whether they be the heel or the finger or the wrist, are pretty accurate if they say your bones are really good or really bad. But if you get in that osteopenic range, then you really want to know what your hip and your lower spine are.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. And if you would like to talk with Dr. Suzanne Troopin, by all means, you can call us at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. Let's go on now to line number two, caller on a cell phone. Hi there.
Hi. I have just a quick question for you. I'm close to 30 years old, and my husband and I would like to start a family, and we probably want to start really trying, and I'm currently on birth control, and we probably want to start trying, early next spring. And my question for you is, I have been seeing my nurse practitioner for all of my regular pelvic exams and pap smears and that kind of thing. Because really my only relationship is with her, is it necessary for me, since we know that we'd like to try to start a family, should I start building a relationship with an OBGYN at this point, or is it okay to do that once I've conceived?
Well, it's certainly fine to go out and find a provider once you've conceived, and that is certainly something that most Americans probably do in this day and age. Midwives can birth a patient, a family practitioner, a board-certified obstetrician-gynecologist, or, in fact, some women who are high risk select to start their care with a perinatologist or somebody who actually specializes in high risk pregnancy. So there are lots of different kinds of practitioners. And maybe at your next visit with your nurse practitioner, you guys can sit down, talk about your individual case and whether or not you'd like the kind of care a midwife would deliver versus an obstetrician gynecologist. It's also worthwhile for most people to go in for what's called a pregnancy planning visit. I thought your question was going to be when to stop my pills,
because
that's a good question ask.
Well, and actually, my nurse practitioner and I have already...
You already covered that one.
Yeah, and we've covered immunizations that I've had. We've looked at my complete medical record.
Uh-huh.
Because I think she'd like me to start right away.
Get busy. The other issue for other women listening, not even necessarily for you yourself, is, well, how many providers do you have a choice of getting on your insurance company? There's only a couple of choices, or like there are some plans that are so limited, there may only be one or two physicians that are fully covered on your plan. Well, you know, maybe you're going to have to see that provider one way or the other. But there's no time like the present to go over different issues. You know, what's your call system? How do I get a hold of you? How often am I coming in for my visits? When do you want me to have my first visit? Is there anything else that I should be doing in terms of, we were just talking about nutrition, so when to start prenatal vitamins, so forth and so on, are good issues to cover with the individual that's going to be delivering your baby. However, I will say that for those individuals who aren't going to meet their provider in advance, that those are things that some nurse practitioners do cover very well.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. And if you would like to talk with Dr. Suzanne Troopin, call 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. That's, you know, that is one of those moments in time over the course of a life when maybe it's a good time to reexamine or evaluate your own health care plan and decide.
Oh, absolutely.
Based on the fact that a lot of folks are in plans that are limiting in different ways. And maybe if suddenly you're thinking it's time to start a family, maybe now is the time to go back and say, well, do I have the right access to the right doctors, the experts that I want to deal with?
And
this.
That's true. On the other hand, some individuals like our town, we have a lot of new individuals coming into our community to start school or to be graduate students, and they just don't have in-depth knowledge of local providers the way maybe some individuals that live in more, you know, stable communities where they've been in the same town for quite a while, and they can spend some time interviewing different physicians and looking specifically at what plans cover what physicians. Of course, all the best laid plans go awry if your employer suddenly wakes up the next day and says, we got a new plan.
Yeah,
and I see quite a few transfers of care, even in the middle of pregnancy. And I'm sure most obstetricians, gynecologists that still do obstetrics will also see.
There are about 7 or 8 minutes left. Still time for a couple of calls if you call right now at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Let's shift gears a little bit here and talk about another study that's out, a vaccine for herpes that only works for women.
I saw that, and I hadn't really had time to really completely understand why that might be. And I suspect there may be more to this than we understand. Most of us realize that there are two main kinds of herpes viruses that circulate around, the so-called type 1 virus that generally causes fever blisters or the so-called cold sores that most people get on their lips, and the type 2 herpes simplex virus that primarily causes the genital infections. And we think of about 500,000 cases per year that we see in the United States, new herpes cases each year. But now most of the research has indicated that many people have subtle cases that they never realize that they even have herpes, and that it's quite a problem, and that the chronic taking of antiviral therapy can reduce the amount of outbreaks that you have. But in fact, if we could just prevent this disease altogether with some sort of vaccination, you'd probably have to vaccine against type 1 and type 2 eventually to really have good effective levels of coverage. And there may be some viruses out there that don't have the same biology as other viruses. And so these so-called, quote-unquote, intermediate type viruses, it can't exactly qualify as a class 2, can't exactly qualify as a class 1. That may escape. So exactly how they design this vaccine eventually is going to be very, very important. And I know that they were testing one new one that seemed to only get good antibody levels in the women that they were testing and not the men. And I don't know that they came up with an explanation as to why that was.
Yeah, no, I
don't think they have.
I don't think so. But
they just said, by the way.
Yeah, oh, by the way. But I think it's important to point out that, you know, as with many vaccines, this is only really works if you've never had a cold sore, as I understand it.
Well, that is the idea, is that we would vaccinate young individuals the way we do for hepatitis. Now we vaccinate babies at birth against hepatitis B, and before they've been exposed, unless, in fact, they caught it from their mother while she was pregnant. And then it helps establish effective antibodies, and then you never get the disease down the line. There are some vaccines that are a little counterintuitive that way. I'm working with one vaccine that specifically is against cervical cancer, and or the human papillomavirus that causes cervical cancer. And we are looking at one group who seems, on basis on testing, never to have been exposed to human papillomavirus, but we're also looking at using the vaccine in individuals that were previously exposed to high-risk types of human papillomavirus and seeing if that will prevent the progression to precancerous changes that could lead to cervical cancer. So there may be some vaccines down the line that can help other individuals as well.
Well, we have a few minutes left. Let's go now to caller on the cell phone, line four. Hi.
Hi. I have had a hysterectomy when I was 25. I'm 34 now. Osteoporosis runs in my family. What kind of hormones or estrogen do you think I should get?
Well, the most important thing for, I know we're getting a fair amount of static, you may want to hang up and listen, but the most important thing for individuals with potentially high-risk situations the way you have had, with you, and I'm presuming your ovaries were removed at the time of your hysterectomy, because if they left your ovaries intact, you're no different risk than anyone else, or at least theoretically you're not. But the most important step is to have a diagnosis and get some testing, figure out where you stand. Are your bones normal, healthy now, in which case you only need low-dose therapy, either with an estrogen or with a bisphosphonate, or are you already into a pattern of accelerated bone loss, and in which case you either need higher dose of estrogen, higher dose of the bisphosphonates, or possibly a combination therapy. There are several new medicines out there. There's calcitonin. There's something called SERM, which is selective estrogen receptor modulators that are sort of, some people call them the designer estrogens, or they're non-steroid type estrogens. There are also new compounds that are going to be released, probably thyroid, possibly parathyroid hormones, so other compounds that we can also use.
Well, let's try and get in one more call. Line number one from Urbana. Hi.
Hi. I started listening late, so I don't know if the doctor discussed estrotest. Did she?
We didn't really discuss it in depth.
I have a question. Does it benefit the heart, and does it matter whether it's half or whole strength? And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. Well, for those who don't know, estrotest is a combination of estrogen and testosterone. And exactly what should its effect on the heart be? And I don't know that we have all the answers. Definitely, it will have some heart benefit. But testosterone, being an androgen, has some adverse effects on lipids that estrogen doesn't have. Having that testosterone will lower SHBG. And we didn't get into this, but SHBG is sex hormone binding globulin. It binds up hormones so that when testosterone lowers that, there's more circulating testosterone and a more androgenic effect on the lipid, which is a little bit counterbalancing the good effects of estrogen on the heart. On the flip side, a lot of testosterone is converted in the body to estrogen, so that with that estrotest, there are other potential benefits, extra benefit on the bone, extra benefit on your muscular strength, extra benefit for sex drive. And so at the dosage that they've formulated that estrotest, either the full strength or the so-called HS, which is stands for half strength, those dosage ranges are still considered heart healthy. But if you had a specific heart problem, you might want to take pure estrogen or some other combination like an estrogen statin therapy.
Suzanne, thanks for bringing by the
well,
baby
thank
pictures.
You. And we'll hope that more women out there get to have a three-dimensional look at their babies soon.
Yeah, and we will talk to you again next month.
Good.
All right, thanks. That is Suzanne Truppen, clinical professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois College of Medicine. She joins us each month for a chat on women's health.